Talk given Sunday, 7th December, 1975. Perfected holy men have lived on earth throughout the centuries. Some, the best known ones, are the founders of the great religions. But there were many others whose names, some of whose names we know, and others whose names we do not know. But the world has never lacked for those who realized fully that they were the sons of man, which is one way of saying that they were the sons of God, or to use the Sanskrit word, the Brahmaputras. What was their influence upon human life? How effective has been their realization and their holiness in lifting the whole of mankind, the entire human race, to a truly human level? This question is particularly pertinent in our own day and age, right now, the last few years. There is no need to labor the point that world conditions are deteriorating very rapidly, and particularly in terms of human beings sinking to sheer savagery. So one wonders what effect have the holy ones had upon humanity as a whole. Now we must bear in mind that we who live a mere 70, 80, 100 years at best ask this question and wonder about it and sometimes perhaps feel despair simply because our time span in the world is so short. We have to set this time span against the vast background of man's evolution from the time he began to emerge upon the globe. We do not know the exact number of years. We have only vague ideas which science has put forward, varying from about 1 million to 4 or 5 millions, and some put it at a little bit higher than that. But the time span for mankind on this globe has been in terms of millions. Your time span, my time span, is in terms of a century at best. We have to bear that point in mind. And next, we must try and look into the nature and if possible, the rationale of the influence of human beings upon mankind on this planet. If we ask the question, how do you regard a man? What is a man? We often get the answer, well, he's a psychophysical organism. He is a body-mind creature. Or, we are told, he has a perishable body but an immortal soul and a spark of the divine in him, and so forth. This is what we are told. And this is the type of expression in language of what the best and the greatest of humans realized as the truth of man for themselves. Their realization found expression in these terms. There are other terms we can use to express what man is today. That is, other terms today to express what man is. We may regard him as a congeri, as a center of energy. And in this context, I'm using the word energy to include, as part of the meaning, what we understand by the word energy in scientific terms. But the energies that science knows of are, do not exhaust the different types of energy which are within man. For example, his mental energies. And something rather more vague, what we call his spiritual energies. The important point to bear in mind is that all these different forms of energy are expressions in variety of the one universal, total, transcendent energy, the indefinable and mostly the unknown yet to us. Now I suggest that we look at it this way, in our day and age particularly, because it helps us to see things more dispassionately, by which I do not mean more indifferently, but with a mind that is calm and poised. We are centers of energy. This universal transcendent energy, this one thing that is the origin, the proceeding, and the fulfilling and ending of the whole process which we witness in the world and throughout the universe, and which forms part of which constitutes our own life process during the 70, 80 or 100 years that we live. We are centers of energy. And since this energy in its wholeness, in its essential nature, is transcendent energy, and this transcendent energy is creative energy, we can legitimately say that each one of us is a center, is an embodiment, in fact, of this transcendent creative energy. Now we have to take in as fully as possible the tremendous import of this fact. We are a congeries of energies, all of which are expressions of the one transcendent creative energy. That means that we are transcendence embodied. We have to meditate on this in the true sense of the word meditation, which means to let the mind be perfectly at peace, poised, free of all assumptions, preconceptions, free of all the limitations imposed upon our minds by our conditioning. You may say this is a very tall order. But if we don't struggle, if we remain quiet and at ease, the mind will suddenly right itself, realize this state of supreme peacefulness within, which will enable its inborn natural sensitivity actually to touch the fact that we are the embodiment of transcendence. That is the real meditative condition. And it is identical, therefore, with the condition of revelation. Revelation is not given to one by another. It doesn't come from outside. And using the complementary word inside in the ordinary dualistic context, it doesn't come from inside. When you are in this state, which is the wholly human state, your very condition, your very being is the actual revelation. You are the embodied transcendence, revealed. You have to wake up in inner awareness. And if you do wake up in inner awareness, the sign which will tell you that this is not incredibly satanic egoism, but the simple truth is the fact that you will never say, "I am the embodied revelation." You will never say it to yourself. Because when you say it to yourself and cognize it as a particular fact, you have denied the transcendence of transcendence. Because it is the measureless, the indefinable, beyond the realm of all thinking and knowing. But you can be that reality. And the barriers between knowing and unknowing are completely absent. There is an awareness present, a totally lighted up awareness. This is the enlightened state. This is the enlightenment of the mind. You are aware of it, but you are utterly free of being discriminatively conscious of it. You see what I mean? It is not a case of, oh, I am embodied transcendence, but that person is not embodied transcendence yet. Transcendence is eternal, not subject to the limitations of time or space or measurement. And this is what human beings are capable of, that they can realize that state of awareness. Each one, the finite, can realize, can enter into that state of awareness which transcends all finitude. And then the words you, I, he, she, it, mine, yours, they all disappear from that context of totality. Without destroying the uniqueness of the incredible variety which transcendence manifests throughout the universe. Now, in some such sense as this, each one of us is transcendence embodied. Why doesn't that awareness function freely through us human beings, always and every day, and so forth? The human being consists of an organism. We cannot deny the organism, the psychophysical organism. The physical part is the most concrete part, the most concrete expression of the one total reality, the physical manifestation. And this physical manifestation acts as an anchor for the mind, the spirit. If you prefer, it acts as the living earth in which the seed of the spirit sprouts and grows and flowers into this marvelous tree of life, of pure life, which is the expression of divinity in all its ways. Now, discriminative consciousness comes into the story. The organism as such is something which is evolving. It grows. All growth, all evolution lies within the particular and limited sphere of mortality. It belongs to the finite, to the measurable, to the realm of change, which is a changing in terms of producing difference all along the line. Your infant is different from the child, who is different from the adolescent, who is different from the adult, from the middle-aged man, from the old man. Our awareness of this change is in terms of discriminative consciousness only. Therefore, what we see is difference all along the line, change all along the line. We cannot take in the totality. At this point, it is important to remember that taking in the totality is never, it is quite impossible for it to be, a case of taking in the totality within discriminative consciousness. It can't be done. Remember that fable, famous old fable, where the mother frog burst. You can't do it. Because discriminative consciousness is bound within the limitations imposed upon the mind by the concept of space, time, substance, causality, cause and effect, and all that sort of thing. This discriminative consciousness has to become transformed. I can't transform it, you can't transform it. Life, transcendence, affects the transformation if you or I do not obstruct the activity of transcendence, this creative action in eternity. And we obstruct because, being discriminatively conscious, we are the slaves of desire and all the planning by the intellect and the activity of the organism to gratify that desire. Someone may say, ah, but my desires are good desires, surely. They are noble desires. I only want to serve my fellow human beings. I'd give my life for them. For them, for God, for the truth, for love, for beauty. Yes, they are fine words. They are also true words if I can really do it. But being discriminatively conscious and being ignorant of the fact that I'm confined within discriminative consciousness, I am unable to do it, to be it. You see what I'm getting at? You can be divinity. You can never attain divinity as a goal. Whatsoever the mind postulates, whatsoever self-oriented desire, and desire can be nothing else but self-oriented. It's impossible for desire to escape that. Whatsoever desire, a self-oriented desire drives you to do, keeps you enclosed within this sphere of mortality. So you can never attain any goal. Any goal is projected out of limitation. and itself therefore is everlastingly limited. The pure longing of the heart, the pure aspiration which goes out of oneself, is always undefined. It has gone right beyond the realm of concept and speech. The moment you can formulate your aspiration, that formulation is going to hide the light, is going to prevent your being transcendence. Now you see, when any and every aspect of I, of the I, is no more, completely no more, in mind and consciousness, then transcendence works freely. There is nothing here in the organism to obstruct transcendence. The perfected holy ones then were centers of influence which radiated the reality of transcendence out of themselves. It allowed transcendence to flow in completely and to flow out unhindered. It is impossible for me to gauge, to judge, to measure that influence. But there are certain things we have seen and do see. Despite the dreadful condition of man today, and as I said earlier, he is descending into savagery in the most appalling way. Despite that, this influence works perpetually. Consider, if this were not the case, from what we do know about the history of man for merely the last 6,000 years, out of the few millions he's been on the globe, man would have been wiped out. He would have committed suicide by now, destroyed himself altogether. How is it that he has survived? Is it because what this man or that woman, you or I or anybody else has done or can do? Not a bit of it. We are as nothing, absolutely nothing. And as soon as we can be free of clinging to this feeling that we mean something, when we are free of that deep-seated, fundamental egoism, then one at least of the great roots of evil in our own individual life and in the life of mankind has been extirpated. But this is a case of seeing the truth. Seeing the truth with such intensity and clarity that one has become that truth. Which means, in actual fact, that one's thinking, speaking, and action in everyday life is spontaneously and naturally fully human and not subhuman. one's whole living is such that he, at least, will never descend into savagery. Simply because he has rendered himself incapable of savagery. Man, if he cultivates the natural gifts with which he may be endowed, can become that which he, with which he is gifted. In the same way, man can unbecome the evil with which he is plagued. And this unbecoming is brought about through this intense attentiveness, the mind in perfect poise inwardly, perfect dispassionate, but as I said earlier, not indifferent observation. See, when I am totally free of all egoism, I am free of the burden of knowledge, of all acquired knowledge. I am free of all the poisonous barbs of memory. Look carefully at your fantasies, at all your recollections from the past. How self-centered they are. How they separate oneself from others. And always oneself is the aggrieved party and the other is the wrongdoer. Consider the pain and misery of all this. Consider how out of that sort of fantasying, recollecting, digging up old memories, one tries to put it right with the past, or to try and persuade the other person to do the right thing by me. Absurdity and futility. That way lies no love, no intelligence whatsoever. That way I, as the ordinary worldling, always go. A fool, and most unfortunately, a damned fool. Condemned fool. Hence, the endlessness of the suffering through memories of the past throughout one's life. There is no freedom that way. There is no possibility then of being this embodied transcendence which radiates energy, which is for the healing of the world, for the whole making of the world, and of course of oneself. Now I suggested 2 points which are the key to the whole situation. This attentiveness and this poised state of the mind. We think, we imagine that we are attentive. Have we ever taken the trouble to look deeply enough into the nature of our attentiveness? How many of us can honestly say. We may be sincere about it, the sincerity of ignorance. But can we truthfully say, because we actually know that this is the fact, that we are attentive in the right way? Whosoever is attentive in the right way is totally egoless, totally unself-centered. Watch the mode of attentiveness which we exercise. It is always related to oneself. I am attending to this. I am examining this. So says the conscious mind. But in the hinterland, in the depths, the unconscious mind, caught in the prison house of desire and its faithful slave intellect, is attending in order to get a desired result for himself. This is what bedevils the whole of the religious discipline. That is why striving to be pure, striving to acquire virtue, practicing this discipline, that method, what this school has taught, what that fellow has said, and so forth, is always held within this sphere of mortality. Death, the wages of sin. You see how difficult it is. But now don't try to see how difficult it is with a sense of hopelessness or with a sense of false hope. There is no room for hope or hopelessness in transcendence. If you are really fit and well and healthy and your organism is full of vitality and life, you're unconcerned about health. You don't start asking, oh, am I eating the right foods? Is my blood pressure all right? Of course I am all right. I mean, you don't even know whether you are all right. Because you are all right. It's as simple as that. And as difficult as that. So, do not approach this with either a sense of hope or hopelessness. Just watch and enjoy the watching. Just see to what extent what I believe is the right thing being done by me is not the right thing. You'll discover it. It will reveal itself to you. If I shut up, the Lord speaks. If I stop doing, rushing about, making a mess of the world, interfering with everybody's life and affairs, the Lord does everything that is necessary. Why do I say that? When I stop interfering and making a mess, doesn't life just go on all the same? Without my doing anything? And doesn't it usually get along a little bit better than when I was fiddling about and making a noise and messing up things? See, we never appreciate what actually happens in our human life. Because, as I said, it is difficult to see these things. Live by letting live. And if one lives by letting live, one has really ceased to interfere, to muddle through, to make a mess. It's not a case of live and let live. And you'll see the subtle difference, and a very important difference. For us in the worldly state, to live means to do this, to do the other, to achieve this, to attain that, to get things comfortable and right and proper for us, and so forth and so forth. To enjoy the senses, to enjoy the gifts with which we may be endowed as artists or scientists or first-class cooks or whatever it be. Let all that happen. It's all of no importance. Just let it happen. Write your symphonies and your poems. That is to say, you are the instrument through which transcendence composes its symphonies and writes its poems. And you will find something totally different in your own life. Most important of all, you will find that the domination of discriminative consciousness upon our lives will disappear. What sort of a center of influence then will one be? An influence for good, for the fulfillment of life which you or I never define. We never make a particular concept, a thought form about it. And in not doing that, we leave all the ways completely open for the truly wonderful and marvelous to come into being unobstructedly. Now, we are approaching one of the great festivals of mankind in the year, the festival we call Christmas, Christ's Mass, the birth of Christ, of the Christ consciousness. The emergence into actual concrete manifestation of that which is represented in that phrase, the Son of God. And the Son of God himself declared, I and the Father are one. The Father, the invisible, intangible, mysterious, unknown, absolute, unimaginable, unthinkable reality. The Son, the particular, the utterly fulfilled, perfected, Holy One, living on earth, like you or like me. It is the birth of this sonship in us. The whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition is filled with this, and its roots lie in the old teaching of the Kabbalah. The sun is associated with the Sephira called Tiferet, which represents beauty, compassion, justice, harmony, tuition, the teacher. And how does this teacher teach? By being the truth, by being the manifested transcendence. His words are simple, they are beautiful. There's nothing clever about them, but they are deep. Deep with the depth of infinity. Those of you who are deeply concerned with Buddhism will recall those words of the Buddha. When Ananda, his beloved disciple, in a moment of exaltation says, "Ah, Lord, deep is the Paticca-samuppada, the doctrine of conditioned genesis." And the Buddha tells him, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so." And then the Buddha just proceeds to say the identical words and expound the Paticca-samuppada as we have it in print in the books. What is the significance of this? One may say, "But how absurd. He said to his disciples, 'Say not so,' as if he were going to say something infinitely more wonderful. He didn't say anything else. He said the same thing. What is the difference?" Ananda's intelligence had temporarily at least woken up to the marvel of the paticca. That mood, that condition would pass by in time. The realization of a Buddha is in eternity. The truth of the Paticca-samuppada is in his living being itself. It's a matter of course, not something to attain, to work at, to study, and so on and so on, but to be. Now, the influence of a Jesus, of a Buddha, has lasted through the centuries. Even in outward forms, mankind has changed. When I said outward forms, I mean in terms of conduct in daily life. Mankind has changed as a result of the teachings of the Holy Ones. Let us bear that in mind with respect to our present situation. You and I here, with this approaching festival, can turn our whole attention with a poised mind to the inward reality of the fact of our sonship with the Father, which I put in these words when we started this afternoon, that each one of us is transcendence embodied. We are the children of the infinite. And even as that infinite is transcendent energy, which is beyond all possibility for me or for an ordinary human being ever to talk of or conceive of, so too our influence, if we are truly realized sons, our influence is like that of the transcendent real. So let us turn our attention these days to that. Don't struggle to attend. Don't try hard to achieve a state of consciousness, because that will just pass away. Just quietly and happily be it. Let it happen, and it will happen. And you won't know it as it is happening, whilst it is happening. And this is the charming part of it. Surely, have not you known throughout your lives that when the really wonderful, lovely thing just happens and you are unself-conscious, then the most wonderful thing has taken place in you. But if afterwards greed comes up and you strive to recall that which has passed away, or to make it happen again as it happened before, then you have tried to spit at heaven. Remember, as the Chinese say, if anyone spits at heaven, the spit only falls back on his own face. So you see, be free of memory, of desire, of all planning, of all self-conscious striving to achieve or to attain or to bring about this, that or the other state of affairs. And transcendence will suffuse you. When that happens, you will no longer care. You'll be quite indifferent, in the right sense. You'll be totally indifferent to whatsoever happens to you. You'll take it in your stride as easily as God Almighty is happy in heaven. So, that happiness, that heavenly happiness, which is the meaning of merriment in heaven, it is that sort of happiness I wish you all. So enjoy a really merry Christmas in that sense. That merriment is from everlasting to everlasting. The Zarathustrian teaching of heaven presents heaven as the place of heavenly song, Garodemana. That's the Avastan phrase for it. The house of heavenly song. So may you live always in that house of heavenly song.